Hello, this is Jamie Peterson with the Herald and Review for Wednesday, February 12, 2020. We begin our reading on the front page. Love to Read, Maroa Forsyth Family Reading Event, A Glowing Success by Valerie Wells. Walking into the Black Light Glow Gallery at Maroa Forsyth Grade School on Tuesday was like being under the sea. The art on display, made with the combined efforts of all the students in grades K through 5, depicted fish and coral and other sea creatures in all the colors of the rainbow, luminescent under the black lights. It was a highlight of the school's family reading night, with a line of families waiting their turn stretched all the way down the hall. Art teacher Terry Doty came up with the idea with the help of an online teachers forum and partially funded it with help from the community club, the school's parent group. They fundraise and the money goes back to students, said Jessica Patrick, intervention specialist at the school who organized the family reading event. This was the third year for the family reading event, always held the week of Valentine's Day. It is well attended, Patrick said, with about 150 families attending to take part in activities that included s'mores and snacks, stations for practicing compound and sight words, tongue twisters, writing a story, and a book fair. We celebrate what we call Read to Love and Love to Read, Patrick said. We read a lot of books that have to do with love and peace and diversity. Until this year, art was taught by parent volunteers, and classes were only once a month, said Khadija Abdul-Rahman, a fifth-grade student. Kids could only make small projects that could be finished in one class. We have it every week now, she said. Now we have an actual teacher. Before we had a volunteer who was a classmate's mom. Now we can do projects that we can do in parts. After every class, while they were working on the gallery, they'd turn off the lights to see how things looked under the black lights and make sure they had gotten their colors saturated enough, Khadija said. But we didn't know how they'd look all together, she said. I love it. Throughout the schools, tables were scattered with various activities families could do together, all based on reading. The Decatur Public Library's Really Ridiculous, which consists of Alyssa Henkel and Susan Bishop performing children's books, gave a show in the gym. And Paw Prince Ministries set up a classroom where kids could read to the dogs. Anything that encourages kids to read is a great idea, said Rebecca Kreitz, who brought Enzo to be read to. Let Enzo lay down and let kids pet him and rub his ears and read whatever they wanted to read. Enzo was joined by fellow Paw Prince dogs Alice, Remy, Paget, and Bella, and all had a steady stream of kids clutching books who wanted to sit down and spend time with the dogs. Remy was so relaxed that he put his head into a boy's lap and almost dozed off. We actually read a lot at home, Kreitz said. Dogs aren't judgmental. They don't really care what the story is, which is really great because each kid has their own interests. Some are reading at different levels. All of those are just great ideas. They can be a calming influence, too, if kids are nervous about reading. Dogs never make fun of you if you don't know a word or if you're a slow reader. Also on the front page from the Decatur schools, Concerns Heard on Stephen Decatur, Board Approves New School Designs, by Annalisa Trofumik. Stephen Decatur Middle School Principal Matt Fraz says conditions at the building are improving in the first year after merging with Thomas Jefferson Middle School. But he was pressed Tuesday by school member Courtney Carson about how the school's administration was responding to safety concerns from students' families. Carson's questions came after a woman told the board that her granddaughter had experienced bullying and harassments since the schools combined and recently had been sexually assaulted by a fellow student while walking home. I'm concerned about the safety and welfare of the children being caught in the crossfire of DPS, Bold planned, the woman said, referring to the district's multi-year facilities plan. Each school day we are sending our children into a war zone. The Herald and Review is not naming the woman who has addressed the board with concerns at multiple school board meetings to avoid identifying her granddaughter. Frost later addressed the board with a presentation about the school's progress, which he described as improving since the start of the school year. Following Carson's questions about the student situation, board member Beth Creighton said the board could not publicly discuss specific students. It is not about the individual students, it's about the response, Carson said. How do we handle that before she brings it to this particular board? As a principal, what do you do to handle situations and concerns? Frost said he's been in contact with the family about the issue, but typically in situations such as this one, the administration collects as much information as possible from the teachers, staff, students, and parents. Anytime we can get video support, whether it is from buses, from cameras in the building, we get that information involved, Frost said. The two schools merged in August as part of the facilities plan, which aims to reduce the number of district buildings from 22 to 17. Some parents have raised concerns about combining the student populations, and a meeting was held in September to discuss altercations, overcrowding, and staff vacancies. School officials have said student safety is a top priority, and steps have been taken to address issues, such as ensuring that students do not move through corridors in large groups. Frost said the school staff work to get support for students who have had disciplinary actions so that solutions are addressed to meet their specific needs. Speaking after the meeting, Carson said the board's top priority should always be the students. He said he hoped the principal would continue conversations with the girl's family to address the situation and her well-being. Ultimately, my first concern is our children and the safety of our children, Carson said. This is an institution where we are trying to provide the best education for our young people. Frost, during his presentation, listed two goals of the school's improvement plan, which includes providing a learning environment that is physically, socially, emotionally, and behaviorally safe and conducive to learning. Also during the meeting, board members discussed updates to several schools that will see changes as part of the facilities plan. Local architecture firm Because Life Deserves Design, BLDD, has been tasked with designing renovations to several schools that will see new classrooms, offices, and other enhancements as part of the plan. Board members on Tuesday approved drawings of instructional spaces at Muffley, Parsons, Franklin, and South Shores. Representatives from BLDD and O'Shea Builders, construction managers for the BOLD plan, presented drawings that featured new classrooms, additions to buildings, and other projects. The district budgeted for over 40,000 square feet of combined renovated space among the four schools. Working cash and health life safety bonds will fund the project in addition to others related to the BOLD plan. Changes to elementary schools will include the merging of Muffley and Baum schools for the 2021-2022 school year at the Muffley facility, 88 South Country Club Road. In addition to the building, will allow it to accommodate more students. Franklin this year will also get an addition so that it can house current students and Oak Grove Elementary students for the 2021-2022 school year. Oak Grove will close in the fall of 2021. An addition to South Shores Elementary School is planned for some students from Enterprise Elementary School who will join South Shore students next year. Other Enterprise students will join the newly combined Montessori program housed at the former Thomas Jefferson building next year. The Stevenson Elementary student body will use the former Parsons building in fall 2021. In other business, board members finalized an updated job description for the future Montessori principal and assistant principal positions to ensure that the positions would be filled by people with Montessori experience. The district announced last month they would conduct a national search for the positions so that they could find the most qualified candidates, officials said. A Schomburg firm was hired for the position, but the district ultimately decided to call off the search after hearing feedback from parents and staff. Board members approved the sale of surplus iPads and MacBooks. A district memo said DPS currently owns 900 iPad Airs that are no longer usable in a manner that best benefits the district through recycling and reselling programs and devices. The Information and Technology Department obtained quotes from three vendors for the iPads, which range from about $3,000 to $25,000. They accepted a quote from Arcoa for about $25,000. Quotes for MacBooks from three vendors ranged from $14,000 to $26,246. The board selected the higher quote from Nilotech at $26,500. Board members also approved an agreement with Green Wave Computer Recycling to dispose of electronic equipment. Under the agreement, most of the items would be recycled for free, while computer units are accepted at a base price. And a notice on the front page. For reader participation, voting is open for Herald and Review's Reader's Choice. Ready, set, vote. Today is opening day for voting in our Best of Reader's Choice Awards annual program, our showcase of the region's best based on nominations from the community. Round one of voting is in the services, people, and medical categories. That wraps up February 18. Round two, featuring the Eat, Drink, Shop, and Play categories, is February 19th to 25. Visit herald-review.com/readerschoice to cast your ballot. Winners will be recognized in the Herald and Review and heraldreview.com on March 29. Thanks for reading and voting. On to page 2. State Investigating Blaze at House in Cerro Gordo by Garrett Karsten. The Office of the Illinois State Fire Marshal spent Tuesday investigating what caused a massive house fire in Cerro Gordo. Crews were dispatched to 208 West Carter Street at 7:15 p.m. Monday after a passerby called to report flames consuming the northeast part of the house, said Cerro Gordo Fire Captain Michael Powell. The fire had been going for about 10 minutes by the time crews arrived. Flames eventually spread across the attic, Powell said. No one was inside. Crews from 15 fire departments, including Cerro Gordo, Argenta, Hammond, Lovington, Cisco, and Long Creek, were on scene for 5 hours. The 2,370-square-foot, two-story house has 5 bedrooms and a basement, according to a real estate listing. And on to local and state news. Out of Lincoln by Lenore Sabota. Snow, Arctic blast, on the way. Dig out your shovel and warm clothes. Winter isn't done with us yet. Snow will be arriving Wednesday, with the heaviest totals of 4 to 6 inches along and north of the Interstate 74 corridor, including Bloomington Normal. The snow will taper to less than an inch south of Interstate 70, with a total of 2 to 4 inches forecast for the Decatur area, but less than an inch around Mattoon-Charleston. A winter weather advisory goes into effect from McLean and DeWitt counties at 11 a.m. Wednesday and continues through 10 a.m. Thursday. A winter weather advisory will be in effect for Macon, Logan, and Coles counties from 9 a.m. Wednesday to 3 a.m. Thursday. Hazardous conditions will affect the evening commute, according to the advisories. Snow should start accumulating around 3 p.m. in the Bloomington area and noon in Decatur, said Lyle Barker, a meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Lincoln. The more intense snow should fall during the evening, he said. The snow should taper off Thursday morning, but then the wind will pick up, blowing the snow around, Barker warned. Be prepared for drifting snow and snow blocking over the highways, causing black ice to develop, he said. Adding insult to potential injury, temperatures will plummet and winds will increase on Thursday. By 5 p.m. Thursday, the temperatures are forecast to be in the mid-teens in Bloomington and Decatur. With winds gusting to nearly 30 miles per hour, the wind chill temperature will be below zero. Temperatures will fall below zero Thursday night in Bloomington and Decatur and only reach the low to mid-teens during the day on Friday. Mattoon will stay above zero Thursday night and flirt with 20 degrees for Friday's high. It's going to be cold and nasty, said Barker. It's going to be Illinois winter. But before you buy your tickets to flee to Florida, be aware that temperatures will rise to the mid to upper 30s on Saturday, and things are looking comparatively balmy for Monday. The forecast calls for a high of 46 in Bloomington and nearly 50 in Decatur and Mattoon. Coronavirus news. Illinois, first state to test for virus. Residents showing symptoms can get faster results in state. By Lisa Schenker, the Chicago Tribune. Illinois is the first state to be able to test for the new coronavirus. Rather than sending specimens to the federal government for testing, the state health department announced Tuesday. Testing is being conducted at an Illinois Department of Public Health laboratory in Chicago, and results will typically be available within 24 hours. The ability to do this testing will mean we'll be able to detect any new cases of novel coronavirus earlier and prevent any possible spread, said Evanda Thomas-Smith, assistant director at the state health department, in a statement. We understand there is concern about this new virus, which is why having test results back quickly can help reduce some of those concerns. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention began shipping test kits to labs throughout the U.S. and abroad last week. People will be tested if they're showing certain symptoms and recently traveled from China or had close contact with a person with coronavirus. Positive test results will still have to be confirmed by the CDC. The State Health Department is in the process of bringing testing to labs in Springfield and Carbondale. So far, 2 Illinois residents have tested positive for coronavirus, a husband and wife who were released from Amita Health St. Alexis Medical Center, Hoffman Estates, last week. The man caught the illness from his wife, who had traveled to Wuhan in late December. The case was the first known instance of person-to-person transmission in the U.S. In Illinois, 44 other tests for the virus have come back negative, according to the Public Health Department. Across the U.S., 13 people have tested positive. As of Monday, 40,544 people had confirmed cases of the virus worldwide, and 910 people had died, all but one of them in China, according to the World Health Organization. Symptoms of the virus can include fever, cough, and shortness of breath. It's believed symptoms appear anywhere from 2 to 14 days after exposure. The CDC has said it's still unclear how easily the virus spreads from person to person. The State Health Department and the Illinois Poison Center have also set up a hotline for Illinois residents to call if they have questions about the coronavirus. Call the hotline at 800-889-3931 or email dph.sick@illinois.gov. My jaw just dropped. Third grader gets special recognition from DPS Assistant Superintendent Dace by Annalisa Trofimik from Decatur. A third grader at Durfee Magnet School was left speechless Tuesday after Assistant Superintendent Jeff Dace gave him a special recognition in front of his class. Dace presented Tevin Ridley with a framed copy of his contract with Decatur Public Schools, where he was hired in April as Assistant Superintendent of Teaching and Learning. The two had interacted earlier this year when Dace visited Tevin's school, and Dace said the moment continued to affect him. "Are you the future me?" Tevin had asked Dace. "And I was inspired ever since," Dace said Tuesday, recalling the moment. Dace had also described that exchange while speaking to the school board on January 28, after the board voted to extend his contract to 2025. The move came despite objections from the union that represents Decatur's teachers, who released a statement criticizing Dace's performance and relationship with staff. Speaking that night, Dace told the board that his focus would remain on serving as a role model for students like Tevin, and he pledged then to present the third grader with a copy of the contract. Tevin was shocked and happy to see Dace in his classroom on Tuesday. "My jaw just dropped," Tevin said. "I thought it was so cool." His classmates were given Dace's business card and were told they could reach out if they ever needed anything. Dace left the class with words of encouragement. "A lot of times you all look at adults as role models," he said, "but I want you all to know that you are never too young or too small to inspire us." Out of Mattoon by Rob Stroud, Decatur provider charged with battery. A home daycare provider in Mattoon has been charged with aggravated battery of a 6-month-old boy, causing shaken baby type injuries that required an extended stay at St. Louis Children's Hospital. The Coles County State's Attorney's Office has filed a felony charge of aggravated battery to a victim under age 13 with a possibility of permanent injury against Carmen M. Patak, 49, of Mattoon, following an investigation conducted by the Mattoon Police Department. Patak and her attorney, Stephen Corum, could not be reached for comment Tuesday afternoon. Mattoon Deputy Chief Sam Gaines said Patak, who was a former Illinois State Police trooper and was a Mattoon auxiliary officer before that, voluntarily reported to authorities on Friday after a warrant was issued for her arrest earlier that day. Patak was released from the Coles County Jail on Tuesday after posting the $2,500 bond amount that was set in her case. Her next court appearance is scheduled for February 20. Gaines said the charge alleges that Patak shook the 6-month-old boy, referred to as KK, in court file while he was in her care on January 23rd. Gaines said the infant's mother subsequently picked him up early from the daycare that day after hearing he was sick, and she took him to Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center. KK was later transferred to St. Louis Children's Hospital. Sarah Bush Lincoln medical staff contacted the police due to KK's symptoms of vomiting and lethargy and the absence of visible outside trauma being indicative of a brain bleed caused by shaken baby-type injuries, Gaines said. St. Louis staff later determined that the infant was suffering from brain bruising and bilateral retinal hemorrhage that would cause symptoms to occur within an hour of him being shaken, he said. "That really helped us narrow down the time frame," Gaines said. The deputy chief said this medical information prompted investigators with the Mattoon Police Department to meet with Patak on February 4 for another interview, during which she reportedly admitted to shaking the infant. He said the police then turned their investigation report over to the state's attorney's office to review for possible charges in court. KK's mother has discussed the case and gave an update on her son's condition to WCIA-TV this week, saying that he is now doing much better and is showing strong signs of recovery. She could not be reached for comment Tuesday afternoon. And now page 4, the Herald and Review editorial board column, our view. Iowa outcome affects our faith as much as we allow. There's nothing like a disastrous confluence of politics, tradition, and technology to set people off in a panic. Iowa's presidential caucus was Monday, February 3rd. By Friday, the results were finally available. One of the main culprits in the delay was a new voting app that the state was trying. Results were slow in coming, naturally causing a 24/7 panic among 24/7 news services. As further digging was done by reporters, violations of caucus rules were discovered. Irregularities were reported, although some appear to be nothing more than irregularities caused by confusion. There is as much blame to be shared as there are fingers to point. There are also enough complaints and concerns about Americans' faith in the election system to make a person think that if so many people are questioning it, maybe we should be as well. The outcome only affects our faith in the electoral system as much as we allow it. The entire saga isn't exactly an example of a group putting its best foot forward. But who has been affected, aside from reporters forced to stay in Iowa longer than they thought they'd have to, and candidates who have moved on out of the state but still bray about the results or lack of the same? The story political reporters and Iowa voters like to propagate is campaigns are born and frontrunners are determined in Iowa. But of the seven presidents elected since 1976, only three, Democrats Jimmy Carter in 1976 and Barack Obama 2008 and Republican George W. Bush 2000, won in Iowa. In that same time frame, only three of eight Republican caucus winners went on to win their party's nomination. This week's events have prompted the quadrennial analysis of Iowa's role in presidential elections. The populace is homogeneous. The method is confusing, outdated, and useless. The outcome is unnecessarily magnified because of the caucus timing, giving disproportionate weight to Iowa's minute tangible effect on the nationwide contest. Should Iowa's caucus be abandoned? That's a question better left to the parties and the state's voters. They can decide whether this week was a one-time perfect storm nightmare of logistics or a precursor to a mountain of other potential problems. Likewise, parties and outside observers may wish to reconsider how they view Iowa's results. As a look through results from the last 40-plus years, Iowa's voting has an effect, except when it doesn't. Also in the editorial column from the Los Angeles Times, administration sides with predatory lenders. One hallmark of President Trump's tenure is the zeal with which federal agencies have sought to shred federal regulations, either by repealing or simply not enforcing them. That's been true even in cases where the deregulation is likely to raise costs for the public more than it will lower them for the industry, as in the case with the administration's effort to ease limits on methane emissions. But the administration's assault on regulations hasn't been confined to those adopted by the federal government. Trump also has sought to prevent state governments from imposing their own rules to protect consumers and businesses within their borders, for example, by suing California for adopting net neutrality rules that bar broadband internet providers here from interfering with the traffic on their local networks. Now the administration is on to its next outrageous proposal. Two top federal bank regulators, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, want to allow lenders to evade state consumer protection laws in order to charge obscenely high interest rates. States have imposed interest caps. 36% is a common maximum because non-bank lenders were charging 100% or more to borrowers with bad credit ratings and, in most cases, low incomes. The state-imposed rate caps make it harder for desperate borrowers to obtain loans that leave them in even worse shape financially, pushing them toward less damaging alternatives. The Trump administration, which had moved previously to deregulate predatory payday lending, proposes to reverse that crackdown. That prompted about two dozen state attorneys general to accuse the two bank regulators of misreading federal law in their effort to erase state consumer protections. They're right. The freedom granted to federally regulated banks doesn't extend to unregulated non-bank lenders. If the administration doesn't abandon its effort to promote predatory loans, the courts should stop it. And more local news on page 5. Woman turns herself in, faces multiple charges. Out of Decatur by Garrett Karsten. Police say a woman nearly struck a Macon County Sheriff's deputy and his canine partner with a vehicle Monday evening in an effort to flee during a traffic stop. A Decatur police officer stopped the 22-year-old woman around 5 p.m. in the 400 block of West Grand Avenue, according to a sworn police affidavit. Detective Sergeant Chris Copeland said the woman had been driving a vehicle with no front license plate. Two other occupants were in the car, a male who gave police a fake name and another person who was not identified, Copeland said. Police asked for the sheriff's deputy and canine, Duke, to conduct a free air sniff around the vehicle. While this was underway, the woman rapidly accelerated from the 400 West Grand Avenue lot and headed south on Edward Street, according to court documents. The deputy said in an affidavit that the momentum from the vehicle's acceleration pushed him and Duke backward, but both were uninjured. Police pursued the woman, and an affidavit said she was traveling 21 miles per hour over the 30-mile-per-hour speed limit. Shortly after, she contacted police and she was in the 100 block of West Cerro Gordo, where she was taken into custody. The woman was arrested on preliminary charges of aggravated fleeing, aggravated battery of a peace officer, and reckless conduct. Decatur Brewery will help you axe your ex, kind of, by Allison Petty. Does this Valentine's Day find you heartbroken or really, really mad? Maybe you'd like to throw something. Alternatively, are you looking to impress a future date with your finely honed survival skills? Either way, Door 4 Brewing Company can help. In partnership with Rocket Axe Throwing, the brewery at 1214 West Cerro Gordo Street will be offering a special axe throwing opportunity starting at 6 p.m. Friday. Axe throwing has been available at Door 4 since last year, but Friday's event comes with a twist. You can write something, say your terrible ex's name, on a paper heart before hurling an axe at said target. The cost is $20 per person if you reserve a lane at rocketaxe.com or $25 per person for walk-ins. There's a two-drink minute maximum during the throwing experience and no outside weapons are allowed. And now page 6, with a column by Stu Ellis. Stu Ellis is an observer of Central Illinois agriculture scene. In addition to his weekly column, you can view his From the Farm and Harvest Heritage reports on WCIA 3 News. Budget doesn't bode well for agriculture. The Trump administration has delivered its proposed budget for the 2021 fiscal year to Congress. Without any surprise, it was described as dead on arrival. With the animosity between the Republican administration and the democratically controlled House of Representatives, there's no room for anything else. However, the administration is required to propose a budget, and the House is charged by the Constitution to originate appropriations. So the politics will be electric, and the plug is in the socket. One of the issues that farmers will be following is the U.S. Department of Agriculture budget proposal, roughly assembled by USDA leadership at 14th and Independence in Washington, then sent to the White House for the Office of Management and Budget to finalize, reflecting the wishes of top administration officials. And there's a lot of room for change between those two locations across the Quad in Washington. When the proposed budget reached Capitol Hill, Chairman Colin Peterson of the House Agriculture Committee saw the 8.2% cut in spending, along with billions of dollars of more cuts in crop insurance, conservation, disaster assistance, and food aid. His response was a bit pointed. This is what happens when ideologues decide to cut programs just for the sake of cutting. We'll make sure that the farm bill isn't cut during this year's budget process. What's worse is the president is proposing all these cuts without any attempt to balance the budget. The past year has brought serious economic damage to farmers and rural communities, yet the administration is proposing to cut billions in programs that they count in many different ways. This budget also continues to shortchange the funding needed to provide adequate service to USDA customers in field offices. Peterson's concern is a $25 billion loss in funding for crop insurance and $9 billion loss to conservation over the 10 years required in the budget proposal. He also expressed concern about the loss of assistance for livestock producers in drought-stricken areas and ending the ability to provide U.S. commodities for food aid. Finally, their proposed changes to the SNAP program reduces SNAP spending by $182 million. That would be over 10 years or more than $18 billion per year. Interestingly, ranking Republican Mike Conaway of the House Agriculture Committee was silent, at least in the form of not issuing any statement of support for the White House budget proposal. He knows that the House will eventually pass a budget written by the Democratic majority and the proposed cuts to agriculture will not be present. And obvious by its absence was any 2020 version of the Market Facilitation Program, MFP, that has provided billions of dollars to farmers in return to billions of dollars of losses from the loss of trade with China. The administration is hedging that China will come through with $40 billion worth of commodity purchases this year and next, and a repeat of the MFP program will not be necessary. This is fine with farmers as long as increased trade rises commodity prices to negate the need for any income transfer programs. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half of the Herald and Review for Wednesday, February 12, 2020. Please stay tuned.